I'd like to ask, could you hear me without the mic if I speak? Or should I speak in the mic?
In the mic?
Yes. Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for being here. And I would like to say that we had a speaker named Karina coming from Las Vegas, and she took ill, and her doctor said in no way should she travel. Is that correct, Jason? Something like that. Wednesday night, I got a call from Adriana, and she said, we're looking for a speaker. There was desperation in her voice. And I felt, oh boy, I don't want to do this. I wanted to just sit at these meetings and listen and absorb. I'm good at a 3+1 perhaps, but not a speaker meeting. I don't do well up on a stage. I'm very happy to see that it's not on a stage tonight. My name is Basil, and Adriana said, Basil, think about it and pray about it and give me your answer in a day or so, a day, because it was Wednesday night. And basically my prayer was, I hope they find someone. Didn't work. But I'm a sub tonight. Oh, by the way, today is Earth Day.
Oh, yes.
Yes, very nice. And the theme, I think, for tonight will be, today is actually Worth Day, because we are worth it. We are really worth it. And we are here to increase that worth in our existence and for those loved around, who love our lovers around us. I'm a sub. I used to sub. So I hope that, like in a high school, you know, when the sub comes in, you don't throw chairs and yell and scream and chew gum and make obscenities. By the way, I was thinking tonight that I used to go to a retreat, a religious retreat, and there was a priest that came and everyone loved him occasionally, and his name was Father O'Donnell. But they would always have some regularly scheduled priest. But when Father O'Donnell would come, he would say, you guys could call me Father You'll Do, because I got a call last night and they said, Father You'll Do. So I'd like to just start with thanking this committee to pull this off in such an incredible way and in making this work. This is really a monumental thing for you to do. I'd like to just say, to start off, my name is Basil, and if any of you, especially guys out there, want to yell out, were you ever called rosemary or cilantro or oregano, do it now. And before we start, I'd like to say that I'm a human cheeseball. And what I mean by that is I would go to these banquets and things and, you know, gatherings, and they would have this cheese, like cheddar with nuts packed into it. I never knew what they were called, but boy did I love them. And it was only 5 years ago, I said, what are they called? And I was told, it's called a cheese ball. What do you think it's called? I said, I don't know, they were good. But I feel like my life, I'm a cheese ball. I'm cheese that rolls around and gets all these nuts stuck in my head of different things, of people I've met, of my life experiences. So I have a head full of cheese ball nuts. And I'd like to start by telling you that where I came from. That's the beginning of my story. I didn't set a timer. I'll set it for 5.5 minutes. I'm sorry. Who has a timer out there?
I already have.
Will you tell me when it's time to finish? Right? Even though it's maybe in 8.5 minutes and you've had it?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Where I came from, I was born in northeastern Pennsylvania in a little coal town called Hazleton, about the size of Santa Paula. Many seasons, and I really loved growing up there. The snow, the winter, the spring. And just walking around that town, it was Polish and Irish and German and Italian, Swedish and English, some Spanish at the time, Russian, Ukrainian, Lithuanian, Slovak, you name it. So it was a wonderful place to grow up, Austrian, you name it. So I had a mom, I call her Mommy. She created a safe, wonderful home. She was a great housekeeper. We sort of lived on a shoestring according to the standards of the day, but we were like well taken care of. There was always bread baking in the house. She was an excellent cook. It was the 50s. I'm half Italian, half Albanian, and she was what I call a Betty Crocker mom because she was part of the new generation. She was first generation. Her mother came from Italy. And so she was like really a modern 50s housewife. But the place was always full of great cooking and we were always well clothed. And she took care of us and sold Stanley Home products to help men's eat, to make men's meat. My dad was, he was born in the coal regions about 20 miles south. My town was a coal town, but it was a city surrounded by coal banks. But my father was born about 20 miles away in a little town of about 500 people near a breaker and a coal mine. He worked in the breaker when he was 12 years old. That's when he started. But my father, who hardly ever spoke a word, he's Albanian, first generation. But my father, who went to fourth grade, spoke seven languages. He spoke English, he spoke Albanian, he spoke Italian, he spoke Polish, he spoke Spanish, he spoke Lithuanian and some Slovak. Wow. And he went out on the road with Jewel Tea Company selling to all the different ethnic groups in that region. But when he was 12, he went to work in a breaker. That's where they bring up the coal for the from the mines and they smash it up into pieces. They break it and then they size it. And he was put for 12 hours a day on a chute with his legs like this as the coal came down, picking out slate and rock and bits of wood and stones. And that's what he did for the longest time.
Sorry to interrupt. The people in the back can't hear you. And if there is this stand here. I don't know if we could put the mic there. And
all right, maybe. How is this? Okay. I'm sorry you couldn't hear me. I'll start over. Hi, my name is Jason. Okay. Well, my dad did not talk much. He was a silent man. He was a good man. And people in that town called him the closest thing to a saint they had ever met because he was just a good, honest, simple man. But he was a man of few words. My mother was the opposite. She was the life of the party. She just constantly told jokes. Her family side was great humorous. Humor abounded. I had uncles who were really outrageously funny and vaudevillians and magicians. I had cousins on the other side of the family, and we'll get to that in a second. My family told a lot of stories about everybody. So the town was full of just ethnic, wonderful, wonderful people, and the stories were constantly coming. I'd like to start out by telling you about my Uncle Gino. He had a little store, a candy store, that sold cigars and cigarettes. Can you still hear me back there? Right, I'm gonna eat the mic, as they say. my Uncle Gino was, a joker. He was a real card, he really was. If we would call the store, he would answer Andruzzi's. And then we would go, Uncle Gino, and here's what we'd hear. You know, or a kazoo. Uncle Gino, is that you? So that was my Uncle Gino, even with customers, right? Occasionally when we were talking to him, trying to explain something, he would take his pen top off and go. So there was my Uncle Gino, and he was always telling things like to customers. He would say, they'd say, is it cold out today for you, Louie? And he'd go, oh, my ass. And they would say, how are things doing? Is business good? And he'd go, oh, my ass. And he was constantly doing that to customers, too. So that was an oddball. I had another uncle, his brother, who was officious, as they say, very efficient. He was an engineer. One time I asked him, Uncle Frank, what did you mean when you said that you were being facetious? And he said, look it up in the dictionary. He talked like this. Look it up in the dictionary, buddy. And I said, we don't have a dictionary. And he said, that's a problem, isn't it? The next day there was a dictionary in the house, and I got to really like words. With my Uncle Gino, he delivered stuff in an old DeSoto station wagon. And I want to tell you about this because it's important to understand that part of the family that I come from. He would go to places, factories, and collect them nickels from the candy machines and put them in candy boxes and put them under the seats of the car so no one would see that he had money there. Also, the car's passenger side did not open. You couldn't get out. You could get in, but you couldn't get out. It had no horn, and the turn signals didn't work. That's the car I took my driving test in. And my Uncle Gino taught me this way. When we'd be driving, he would say, don't stop, don't stop, there's nobody coming. I'd say, it's a stop sign. He'd go, hit it, damn it. That's the way I was taught. Of course, I rebelled against that, and I followed the rules, you know. But anyway, before the driving test, we had to go, I helped him sometimes, we had to go to a store, to the movie theaters at the time had vending machines, and we got the nickels, and the car was full of nickels. So I got to the driving test with this car. The instructor, my uncle, who was driving, told me to get out and open the door. I opened the door, the instructor got in, I got in, we started to drive. Oh, by the way, the brakes didn't work so well either. So we were coming to an intersection and he said, intersection, what are you going to do? And I said, slow down, and I pumped the brakes, pumped the brakes, pumped the brakes, pumped the brakes, and finally we came to a stop. A bus pulled out in front of us and he said, hit your horn. Chiku, 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 no horn. So all of a sudden, somebody pulled out in front of me and I really jammed the brakes down, and all of a sudden about $50, maybe $100 worth of nickels poured out from under the seats all over the instructor. And there was one more thing. The top liner, when it was up with tacks, the little strip, that's a decorative strip, when I hit the brakes, came down and cut the instructor on the face. I was cooked. I'm 15 and a half. I was sure I was never going to drive again and be like the guys who could drive a car downtown and all the girls would really wow, you know. Not, I couldn't do it in my uncle's car. But he tried to get out and he couldn't. And I was sweating. I was really, really scared. I was trembling. My voice was like this. I said, wait, I'll get the door. And I opened the door, and he said to my uncle, he said, Louis, come here. He goes, Louis, the kid passes, but this piece of junk should stay here. But he let us take it home. So that was my family, and we had a lot of fun. But the other side of my family were the coal miners. And here's where AA comes in and Al-Anon comes in, because we had a lot of drinking on that side of the family. By the way, my father drank rarely. I remember once at a wedding, he had one beer, and it was sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. And an old coal miner came up to him and said, hey, Frankie, you don't drink very much, do you? And my father said, no, Mike, just sociably, and he did. So he wasn't an alcoholic. But his brother, I mean, he wasn't a drinker. His brother, my Uncle Diomedo, an Albanian, which we called him Dimmy. Dimmy was an alcoholic. I call him Uncle Oozin Boozin, because every time I'd meet him, he was oozing booze. And you couldn't get away from the smell. I'd like to just tell you that uncle I didn't see much. He was a black sheep of the family and was always away. Hi, David. And he was always, he was the black sheep of the family, left the area, went to Philadelphia about 90 miles away, and no one ever really saw him. The one story I remember about my Uncle Jimmy and his drinking is that my father brought a new 1936 Chevy coupe. At that time, they were $600. My father, by this time, had a job. He was the boss of like 9 or 10 guys at the breaker where they cleaned the coal, and he could afford that car. My Albanian grandfather, when my father brought it back the first day, got a flat, and my Albanian grandfather said to him, "No good, Frank. Take it back. No good, this car." And he had explained, "Dad, it's just a flat." But my Uncle Jimmy, who drank and drank and drank, took it out one night and overturned it when he was in a blackout and crushed the front roof and backed it into the garage and got up earlier than my father and went to work. When my father saw it, he was furious. My father had a sporadic temper. So the next day, he waited for his brother to come home from work, and my father had a fence paling. And boy, did my father give it to his brother. But nothing changed, because the drinking didn't stop. The weddings, I remember, on my mother's side, were pretty nice affairs, very polite. But when we went to the weddings in 20 miles away in the coal town, well, the way I like to put it was everyone drank. My Uncle Jimmy, when he was at that wedding, I remember when they would pass around trays of shots, my Uncle Jimmy would take a shot, hold on to the tray, take another one, and then take two more. And he was constantly drinking, constantly drinking. Every wedding I went to as a kid, I remember, I call it blood on the tuxedos, because something would happen at the wedding. It just wasn't a normal wedding. It was a cold town, rough town wedding. Not all were like that, but there it was. All of a sudden, the music would be playing, and I would hear, bam! I would see the drummer get knocked off the stage because he had made a pass at one of my cousin's girlfriends. A fight would break out, and blood would be on the tuxedos. There'd be punches thrown. Everybody's drunk. But I always remember the women, and I considered them my first meeting with Alan on women, because here's what would happen. My father wasn't a fighter, but he was a wrestler. And the women would form a line like from here to the door outside the hall, and they would have spatulas and wooden spoons. And my father and others like him would go in and grab the fighters and throw them down this gauntlet of women who would splash soda on them and hit them with the wooden spoon and said, "Stop the drink, or stop the drink, or get out, or you're drunk." And they would throw them out the door, and that's the way a lot of weddings ended. But it was normal for me as a kid, you know what I mean? Because it was like, that's what you saw at the end of, aren't all weddings supposed to end up with the tuxedos with blood on and people getting banged with wooden spoons? So anyway, in 1954, by the way, my mother used to go to parties and dress up, and my father was a man's man, like Gary Cooper or three-piece suits when he went out, very quiet. But I remember that when they went out to one New Year's Eve party, she was dressed up with slacks, a white shirt, a mustache, a sombrero, and a guitar. And my father was dressed like Carmen Miranda with fruit on his head and boobs and bare midriff. And here was a man's man going out. He loved my mother. He loved my mother. I was lucky I had a father who loved my mother. My mother developed breast cancer. This was 1954, and she had a mastectomy. And when she came back, I was 13. And I don't know where I got this, and this is part of this program, I think. Something comes up from inside us, because she showed me the bandage when she came back and stooped down in front of me and said, "Would you like them? I have to say this word. It's hard for me to say in mixed company, but she asked me this. She said, "Would you like a mother with one titty?" And I just looked at her, and I went, and I remember this, and I hugged her, and I said, "I like you just the way you are." And I don't know where I got that. I think it came from where we live, our heart, where we are. My father wanted his brother. Then my mother went out and was good for 30 days. I mean, she was home for 30 days, but then something happened. She went back to Philadelphia and she died. Something to do with a collapsed lung. And my father, when he told us all, told a story that she died, but then they brought her back to life. And he said, "Teresa, do you know where you were?" And she goes, "Oh yes, Frank, I was in a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful field of flowers. And I could see our Lord sitting under the tree there. And he was picking and smelling flowers. And I asked him, he asked me with these beautiful eyes, Frank, he looked up and said, Teresa," that was her name, Teresina. He said, "Teresa, what do you want from me?" And she said, "Oh Lord, I would just like to live to see my children grown." And Frank, he smiled the most beautiful, loving, kind smile. And then he got up and walked through the field of flowers. And a half hour later, she died. Now, my father wanted his brother at that wake, at that funeral, my alcoholic uncle who he never saw. So my father took his second best suit, and in that time, a lot of money, I think it was $15, and sent it to him saying, "Please come, I need you here." And he didn't show, but when the first night of the wake, I looked down the corridor and I'm sitting near my father, and the casket's here with my mother, and people are talking to my father, and I could hear it, you know, like they say in Snoopy, you know, I mean, the Peanuts, wah, 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 all the adults talking. God will is God's will, Frank, you know, sorry for your troubles. If anything we can do, I heard all that. But I turned and I looked, and down the hallway, in the dark, there was my Uncle Dimmy, standing in the shadows. The alcoholic had come. My Uncle Oozin Boozin had come. And I turned and I saw him, and it was wow, because my father said he won't come. And I turned to my father, but he was talking to people, and I never would interrupt adults. And I wanted to shake his arm and said, "Daddy, Uncle Dimmy's here," but I didn't. After he was finished talking, I said, "Daddy, Uncle Dimmy's here." And he went, "What are you saying?" And we looked down the hallway, and it was empty. He had gone. And folks, it took me 45 years to realize what had happened to my uncle, the alcoholic. He could not cross over into that room. He could not cross over into the light. He could not cross over to be with the family. He could not cross over to be with the family of man, because he was isolated, and women, because he was isolated by his own illness. And that continued for him. He couldn't. After my mother died, and my father died, I forgot to say this, the house really changed after my mother died. There was no more bread rising on the radiator covered with an afghan. There was no more pies being cooked. There was no more food being cooked like she cooked. My Albanian grandmother came to live with us. But I went into depression, and I know it now. I was depressed. Things had changed. I tried to do everything I could with my two sisters. They're both 4 years younger than me. When my mother died, I was 13. My one sister was 9, and the other was 5. And we tried to bond. We did, and we had fun together. But I knew I was going into some kind of depression. A teacher in school named Mrs. Schlenker, algebra teacher in 9th grade. God, teachers. Mrs. Schlenker had 3 different colored hair. Red, brown, and sort of an orange. She had thick glasses, she had a leg brace, and she smoked. You could tell, because when she came back in the classroom, she smelled of smoke. And she was a tough, tough, tough algebra teacher. She gave no leeway. And how am I doing on time?
Got it, half an hour.
I have what?
Half an hour.
Half an hour. She was a friend of my mother's, and I was starting to sink. My grades were getting really low. I was like a C minus student in algebra anyway. But she came to me one day and she goes, "Listen, algebra is just a series of steps. You put your mind down to it. You follow all the examples on the board, the chalkboard. Copy them down in your notebook, and when you go home, you follow the examples, the samples, and that's the way you do the work. Follow a series of steps, Basil. Follow a series of steps. And I did it. And I became an A student for a while. Then I went back to my place in the middle of the room. But Mrs. Schlenker, that series of steps, I didn't know how valuable that would be, because later would come the 12 steps. When my Albanian grandmother came to live with us, her stories were the stories that I heard my whole life, especially things like in Albania at Christmas, when they would have Christmas Eve, and then at midnight they would open these big wicker baskets, and doves used to fly out, and she used to go, and Bezi, she called me Bezi, she goes, Bezi, come midnight, they open the basket, and the bird go poop, 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 all over the church. So beautiful, so beautiful. And she called me Bezi, and she was my main supporter, because no matter what I did, I know I was her son's son, but no matter what I did, I could do no wrong. I could do cutting a hedge, and she would go, go, Bezi, go. Go, Bezi, go. Bezi, when you do, nobody can beat you. You're the best, Bezi. And that was so great for me, for my self-esteem. So my dad drove a pie truck, and after my mother died, he started taking me on the pie truck to help. We went out at like 3 in the morning on Wednesday, and then I would get help him load the truck and come back at 5 o'clock, go to bed and go to school. I went out with him on Friday, the same thing, Saturday all day and all the holidays. But here's another thing. I would, in the midwinter, put his jacket in front of the oven to get it warm. I don't know why I did that. It was just because I cared about my dad. But I keep talking tonight about, where did that come from? Where does that come from? And we sold pies. When I was driving with him in his truck one day, we stopped at a restaurant, and I'll never forget this song, because I love pies, but I heard this pie on a country radio station, and I'm going to tell you why I like to sing in a little bit. But here's the way the song went. I remembered as a kid, country western. Cherry pie, cherry pie, oh Lord, I love that cherry pie. Oh, my mother makes the filling, and oh, Lord, I'm willing to eat my fill of cherry, cherry pie. So in the truck, yeah, in the truck, my father didn't know this, but we very rarely got a pie because they were expensive. They were 90 cents for a restaurant pie in 1957, believe it or not, plus 10 cents for the tin, which you return. But I had a fork hidden. And when there'd be strawberry shortcake, when he wasn't in the truck, I would go get that fork and take a strawberry out and then smooth it out. one time there was a mechanic, and my father, like I say, did not speak much. He did not speak much. Probably one of the biggest things I heard in the day was, Basil, you want to eat? And for a teen, oh my God, yes, that was wonderful. He once stopped the truck. And he just said, watch this guy. It was sort of like winter was waning. A tow truck pulled up and the mechanic got out. The guy had one arm. The guy took the big heavy jack and put it under this car. He gave it a couple of jacks. With that one hand, he took off the hubcap. He loosened the lug bolts by using his foot to push. He took off the tire with that one arm. He put it in his truck. He got out the spare from the trunk. He put the tire back on the car. He put the lug nuts on. With his foot again, he tightened them. He lowered that big heavy jack and he put it back in the truck. My father said nothing, but what a lesson I got. He just started the truck and we drove away. The lesson was, look what he could do with one arm. That was my father. He began to get sick. My father came down with what's called Hodgkin's lymphoma. Is that right? Lymphoma? And he started to waste away. I spent time with him when he'd go to the hospital in Philadelphia. And later he came back to my Aunt Susie's house in the coal regions. And I remember him mounting the stairs, looking up. He was so thin. and starting to get jaundiced and so sick. And I would help my father. I was with him quite a bit. I was like a caretaker to help him use the night bucket and help him wipe and give him things. But his death was something because he started to fade. But before he did, somebody came up from the coal mines whose brother had a big company, and they had my father beaten up because he was a steward of a union. My father was a steward. And this guy's brother had my father beaten up. But I remember the guy coming up, and his name was Mike, and the brother who had my father beaten up was named Connie. They're Irish. And my father was sitting down. My father was in bed, and this guy Mike is next to my father. And my father was so gracious. He was in pain. He was on painkillers. And he said, "Mike, how's your brother Connie?" And Mike said, "Oh, Frankie, he's a really sick boy." And my father said, "Oh, that's too bad. Tell him I send my best, Mike." And I was blown away by that. A few days later, my father started to breathe the death rattle. And my grandmother came over. She was over him in Albanian saying prayers, "Frankie, Frankie, kwesin ja ja," in Albanian. And I saw my father breathing, and everything was still for me. It was still and quiet. I was like a camera just recording. And my father, his breathing was labored, and finally my grandmother was over him going, "Frankie, Frankie," her first son. And all of a sudden my father took in this deep breath. He went, and then he reached up and grabbed my grandmother, hugged her, and said, "Mom, gone." But I was still in that place. My old uncle Gregorio came up and put a bandage around my father's chin, put 50-cent pieces to close the eyes, pulled a sheet over him and said, "Vasilia," that he called me in Albanian, "Basil." He said, "Get to your father's shoes." I got my father's shoes and we went down to the grapevine, and he said, "Dig a hole by the root." And I just obeyed. I was in another place. I was in serenity. I was at peace. I was one with something divine. And he said, "Mette lo fado su scapo in questi." Put your father's shoes in the hole. And I did obediently, not questioning. Then he said, "Put the dirt." And I put the dirt back. And then he said, "Go get the water." And I got a big bucket of water. He said, "Water." And I watered the roots of the grapevine. He puffed his pipe and he told me, he said, "Vasilia, next year, your father's shoes is going to come in the grapes." Took me a while to realize that the rotting leather would fertilize and my father would be in those grapes. I did go back a year later, but by this time I was 17 and a half, and girls interested me a lot. And I tasted the grapes, and they tasted like grapes. But we went to live after that with my mother's mother. At 16, we still bonded, my sisters and I, and had fun and laughed. I went to high school. I was a good boy. I only had 3 friends, all male. I never talked to a girl in high school at all. I just was that shy. In track, I was on the track team. I never won a race, but I love to run. That's my motto in my life. I've never run a race, but I love to run. But the last race of the year, there was something happening. It was like a miracle. There was a guy from the opposite team. I know I wasn't going to place first, second, or third. When I ran, the dogs were on the field. People were taking pictures of their kids, and I was always last. I was the slowest miler in the history of the school. But the guy who I was next to for fourth place was sick. He was going, "Oh my God, oh my God." It was a hot day. He's going, "Oh my God." He'd go into the bleachers and throw up. He said, "Oh, I went to my brother's bachelor party. I got loaded. Oh, Jackie, I don't know if I can run." And I'm going, "Yes, yes, oh God. I'm running against this guy. And he was puking and sick. And they said, first call for the mile, second call for the mile, third call for the mile. So the race started, and I was ahead, and I was ahead, and I could hear him behind me. And I'm running as fast as I can, and there's about 50 yards to go, and I turned it on, but the son of a bitch was catching up. I could hear him going, flop, 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 and he was running for all he was worth. I beat him by about 2 feet. And you're supposed to get your letter for that, but they forgot to give me my letter. So anyway, I'd like to just get into some deeper stuff, but I want to finish with Lily, my teenage heartthrob. I watched her through 3 years of high school. She had brown hair, high cheekbones. She was, I think she had some Indian in her. She had her poodle skin, or poodle dress. And I used to make sure that I would see every class that she went into. I never talked to her, but I would always watch her in the hallways and see her. Lily, she was my dream girl. 35 years later, I went back to Pennsylvania for a class reunion, and I was in a store, and all of a sudden, there's this lady, about 300 pounds, dyed blonde, smoking a cigarette with about a 20-year-old boy, screaming every F word you can imagine at him, and smoking a cigarette, and she looked familiar, but no, and she left. And the guy said to me, great, huh? I said, who was that? He goes, her name's Lily. So my dream girl ended up to be a 300-pound drunk nightmare lush in a moo-moo. Anyway, my dad's mom died. I did see my Uncle Jimmy again, drunk. And I began to see a sadness in him. I started to see something in the alcoholic in my life. I went to college. I never smoked a cigarette in my life, and this will come in a little bit. How long do I have? 15? Okay. There was a cigarette. My friend smoked cigarettes. I used to drive with him, card share, smoke Pall Mall. I never smoked. I was on the track team. I ran. I lifted weights. I did all that. He said, you want a cigarette? And I said, no. And I love the cool way he'd take it out, put it in, get a Zippo and light it. It was so cool. Every day that he would smoke, I would keep the windows down. I didn't smoke. After 2 weeks, I took one and I smoked and I coughed my guts out. 3 days later, I took another one and I still coughed my guts out. By the end of the week, I was smoking. And the end of the week was when I bought my first pack at 19. I smoked for 12 years, like 2 packs a day. So that cigarette comes in a minute here. In theater, I started out teaching biology, I wasn't making it. I wasn't making it in the chemistry lab. I wasn't making it in bacteriology, cytology. I was drinking, you know, pitchers of beer with all the other college students, and smoking. But I was drafted. Before I was drafted, I got cast in a play. And in the play, I had to die. It was an arena theater, and that's in the round where the audience is very close, like as close as I am to Joy. That would be an audience member. And each night I had to die, and I remember my father's death, the way he died. And I used that. I used that knowledge to act out the death of this character. But the woman who played my mother would lean over me. And every time I had to take a breath, she would move the blanket or something so the audience couldn't see that I really wasn't dead. But one night, there was a little 8-year-old sitting right where Joy is sitting. I was a little closer than that. And I could feel these eyes staring at me, because when the lights came down, I would slip out of the bed and crawl off the stage. But all of a sudden, in the silence of that night, I was dead, and they're giving the eulogy and everything, and I could hear this little 8-year-old voice saying, in a loud whisper in the theater, you're faking. and that's what happened. So I was drafted. I was sent to Monterey, California, to radio operator school. After I got out of the Army, I stayed there, and I worked as a handyman. I had a truck. And then I hitched to Hollywood one day to audition for a Peter Fonda movie, and I didn't get it. It was just the extras. But on the way back, I was going to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I noticed these two girls. They were hippie days. One was dressed in a long hippie skirt, long blonde hair. The other one was dressed in buckskin, and they were smoking cigarettes, and I was going to go buy a pack of cigarettes. So I went up to them, and I said, could I bum a cigarette from you? The blonde gave me a cigarette. Then we got picked up in a pickup truck, and that blonde and I stayed together for 11 years and had four kids, four sons. So without that cigarette, I never would have been here today. But somehow I always felt like in our relationship, I was damaged goods, and I found out later that she was the adult child of a violent alcoholic who drank. Very vicious family relationship, fights, tables being overturned. They didn't know. This was my first contact with it. I didn't know that when her father came home, he was a cop, after he took his gun out and put the bullets in the case, if he would turn and hug their mom and give her an orchid, or overturn the table and slap the daughter silly for wearing Levi's. It was that, and our fight with the older son. And she grew up in that. And with my damaged goods, all through the 11 years with her, I never heard once anyone say, go to Al-Anon. I never heard that. We had arguments. I was dominant. She was 10 years younger than me. We broke things, yell and scream. I slapped her a couple times, and she hit me a few times with some really good ones with the poker from the fireplace. She was a great mom, but that's what our kids lived with. And she was a great mom and ran a great house. But my sons began to drink when they were 14. I had the custody of the two older ones. They began to use and run away, and I got into the cop mode. I still didn't go to Al-Anon. I was tailing them, nailing them, jailing them. And I have to tell you, there was something exciting about the hunt, to find out where my kids are, track them down and bring them home and yell and scream at them and threaten at them and lock them in their room and give them consequences. Tail them, nail them, and jail them. Dad the cop. But it didn't work, even though the hunt was on. And as my sponsor says, the family of alcoholics can become neurotic. And our family was neurotic. I put them both in drug abuse programs and a CAPA in Port Hueneme. And they were part of the Palmer drug abuse. And for me, still no Al-Anon. No one ever mentioned it. One night when I couldn't find my sons because they were out drinking somewhere, the age of 12, 14, I went into Denny's at 3 in the morning, and I had gotten a job working in a high school, and I usually had to be there at 7. And this guy was an EMT driver, looked up when he saw me come in. He said, what are you doing here? And he was a friend, and I said, I'm looking for my sons, and I told him my story. And I'll never forget this. He was looking in the mirror at Denny's, and he was drinking his coffee, and he looked up me through the mirror and said, hey, Basil, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I did, and that started it off. It helped a lot. My older one went to the Navy, but my younger one of the four got the disease. The two younger ones were okay. The older one and I are estranged. He hasn't spoken to me in 10 years, no matter what I do, Christmas cards, phone calls. And I'm working with my sponsor to get over my fourth step, which I've been on for 2 years. And he says, we'll keep going. And I want to get out of it this month. I got a steady job in a high school working with kids. And it's the woulda, coulda, shoulda. I wished I would have had the teaching experience of teens before I had my two sons, because and I realize it's different when you have your own kids. So my sponsor doesn't like to say qualifier, so he says motivator. Well, my motivator began to use. He motivated me to be here. My motivator got me to go to Al-Anon regularly. My motivator drank. He used cocaine. He used drugs. He went to prison 3 times. The last time, when he got out, he had a sponsor who's sitting here, and I'm very grateful to that sponsor, because when my son tried to take his own life and overdosed and barely made it, when he came out of that blackout in that hospital room with needles, there was Dawn, sitting next to him, his sponsor. I'm so grateful for that, that sponsors do that. I'm so grateful for the program, that this way is the way we help each other. I wasn't working the program, though, until maybe about 3 or 4 years ago when I got a sponsor. I started to do the step work again. I was part of men's group. I had a sponsor 20 years before. Okay. And I didn't like what he was telling me, because he was telling me, your life has become unmanageable because theirs is unmanageable. You have no control over alcohol. I was naming, blaming, and complaining with my sponsor about him. I didn't like him because he was telling me what I had to do to get my stuff together. And so when my son was in prison one time, I was starting to talk to him because I had been in Al-Anon. And I had been part of a mental health group that taught about how to talk to people. My son has a dual diagnosis. He's an alcoholic addict and he has bipolar. And I was learning how to talk to him. And our talks were much different in prison. And at one point, the people in the mental health program said, we'd like you to become a teacher after you finish this class. And I said, no, I can't do that. I'm not any good at that. I couldn't do that. And they said, just take the training. And there's a book you can study, and it's all scripted. And we think your experience with alcoholism with your son would be of benefit, and his mental disorder. Well, I didn't want to. And I also wanted to sing, but I never took a lesson. So I went to talk to him one day at visiting, and he told me, he said, he was very upset, and he said, you know what? I don't like talking to our family because they're always ragging on me about you're going to be a drunk the rest of your life, you're going to be going in and out of prison on the revolving door, this is your second time. You know, you're not going to make it, you're not going to make it if you keep drinking like that. Every time you get out and you're off parole, you hit the bottle again, probably even when you're on parole. And he goes, I don't mind talking to you because you don't rag on me. You don't criticize me. You don't tell me what I should do. You just come to see me. When I got out of that prison that day, I pulled over by the side of the road and I started to cry. Something was working. Al-Anon was working for me. Some of those things, I like, wait, why am I talking? Or waste, W-A-I-S-T, why am I still talking? That really began to affect me. It really began to affect me. And take it easy. Easy, does it? I remember the old Italians. I started to really catch on because when there would be fights going on, I'd hear the old Italians go, take it easy, easy does it. They must have been in the program, the Italian version. Well, so I think we all want to stay connected. And I know that from here to here is 2 handspans, 9 inches, 18 inches. And after I got out of that program that day, I called the mental health place and said, I left a message saying, I'd like to take the course. I'd like to try to help others. And I also called a singing teacher I know and said, I'd like to take singing lessons. And I started to do that. And so this brain to heart thing really, really is amazing, this short distance between our brain and our heart. And I'm sure you know this. I could while away the hours, conversing with the flowers, consulting with the brain, and my head I'd be scratching while my thoughts are busy hatching if I only had a brain. And when I started connecting from brain to heart through Al-Anon, it made a big difference to me. I connected to this heart, to this insanity, to this sanity, because my son, the qualifier or the motivator, said to me not less than a year ago, he goes, Dad, what's the difference between sanity and insanity? And I go, what? And he goes, when without insanity, you're sane. Just break off the I-N and you're sane. That was very powerful for me to hear that. He still goes through it. It's a tough road to hoe. I love him, I love him, and I love him. I heard the definition of God once in India. An Indian guy said, he goes, "What is God? What is God to you?" And what? And he goes, "God is operator, generator, and destroyer. He creates us, he sustains us, and then he takes us back." Then I came to Al-Anon and I found out God meant good, orderly direction. Also, grace over drama. When I was in Australia, I met a group of recovering alcoholics and I said, "What does God mean to you here in Australia?" And one said, "Oh, mate, it means group of drunks." and I love that. So I think in Al-Anon we are all storytellers. We have a lot of storytellers and we are poets. I really think we are poets. I was picked up when I got out of the service. The buses had stopped. It was Christmas Eve. I was in uniform, AG-44 with my duffel, and I couldn't get a ride. The guys in this bar in this little town said, "The mail truck's coming through with Boyke at midnight. He'll give you a ride. He drinks, but he'll give you a ride." So when we got in the truck, it was snowing like hell, and Boyke offered me a drink from his hip flask, or his bottle, his pint. I didn't want it. But as we drove, he said something I'll never forget. It was snowing like hell. All of a sudden, it stopped snowing. And he went, "Son of a bitch, look what just happened. It's like walking from one room into another." And I went, "Oh my God, a drunk poet." And there are poets everywhere. So this song that came from Al-Anon, I know I'm getting close here, but I realized in Al-Anon there were just moments that helped me heal. And this song was actually the first song I sang with my singing teacher. It's about what's inside. It's Richard Rodgers, and Rodgers and Hammerstein were a team, and they were together for many, many years, South Pacific, Sound of Music, you name it. But when Roger Hammerstein, the lyricist, died, Richard Rodgers, who wrote the music, was depressed. He had no partner. But he wrote a musical called No Strings. And this was the first song I learned, and this is the first song that I began to practice. But I love what it says. It says this: "The sweetest sounds I'll ever hear are still inside my head. The kindest words I'll ever know are waiting to be said. The most entrancing sight of all is yet for me to see, and the dearest love in all the world is waiting somewhere for me, is waiting somewhere for me." I take that to mean higher power waiting for us. So I've learned that a person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. And my relationship with my son is pretty good, thanks to his sponsors. I like "take what you like and leave the rest." I thought of that this morning. Take what you like and leave the rest. Isn't that interesting? We go to the market and we buy a few bananas. We don't buy the whole bin. We leave the rest, unless you're going to make banana bread and a ton of it. But anyway, I think that's about it. I just want to say that my Aunt Lena, I didn't know in my family until recently. Her husband was an alcoholic. She lived in Indianapolis. At her funeral, there were 350 Al-Anons there. And I've been impressed with Al-Anon ever since about the way this group works and helps. Like at George's memorial for her sons 6 years ago, that's the first time I saw Al-Anon in action. Everybody pulling together with a big feast. There were like hundreds of people there, and there was food, just like today, the enormous amount that goes into setting it up. Last year at George's memorial, there were so many people, and the same thing happened. I'd just like to mention something about Cindy P., who passed away. There are two Cindys. One is here, called Cindy P., and the other one, who passed away, is called Cindy P. What I love about Al-Anon is the openness. because Cindy P., who passed away, was Mexican. Cindy P., who is here today, is Anglo. And they refer to themselves at each meeting as, I'm Cindy P. I'm white Cindy, and this is brown Cindy. And I love that. So I would just like to show you one thing. I had another song to sing, but I think I'm out of time. I would like to show you this. When you the song goes, when you think you're at the bottom and you're really feeling low, you'll be all right mañana. There's still a long way further that you could go. And I related that to this. When the toothpaste tube was empty one day, I said, wait a minute, I've squeezed it, I've rolled it up, I've hit it with a hammer, I've pushed up, I've gotten everything out, but I have never in my life cut it open. I cut it open, and I found out you could get about a week and a half more toothpaste. So, never give up hope, and that's what I want to put up here right now. First of all, this is my sons gave me this as a Christmas gift. It's God touching Adam's fingers with that gift of life, that life that comes back into us, and that's what I find out we get in Al-Anon. Also, I'd like to show you this, which is Never Give Up, if you've never seen it. And I have about 50 or 60 copies of it here on the table for you to take if you like that. But another program, it just says never give up, but in another program they also say never give up hope. So, being that it is Worth Day, I would like to say this as I finish. I was so scared that I wouldn't be able to talk, but I have about another hour to go. As my family would say, Basil, shut the hell up. So here's the song. Happy Worth Day to you. Happy Worth Day to you. Happy Worth Day, everybody. Happy Worth Day to you. And let's sing it together for a finale. Here, you know the words. Happy Worth Day to you. Happy Worth Day to you. Happy Worth Day, everybody. Happy Worth Day to you. Thank you for letting me be here.